accession number 9227, reel 3.
Mr. Brown, reel 3. I think you were saying the Japanese had been infiltrating into the colony.
Yes, they. One realised later there were Japanese everywhere. There were Japanese barbers, there were Japanese working in hotels. They were all round the place in various ways, one or another. And it was quite clear that they were there spotting and finding out what was going on. So it was clear later on when the war did break out, in fact. We had a defence line on the north shore of Hong Kong of pillboxes and so on. They must have pinpointed those absolutely spot on, because in one night the whole lot were just obliterated. I mean, they knew exactly onto a map exactly where anything of importance military was, well before the war broke out. So they were there, and this was another feeling, you know. Well, they are there, they are on the border. It must happen sometime. But in a typical way of Hong Kong head, Hong Kong ignores problems. It lives. It doesn't really look for tomorrow. And Hong Kong boomed. There was no feeling of despondency. There was no feeling of at all. It just goes on living. This is a feature I found of Hong Kong. It's life. It just boomed. It just bustled. And, oh, well, something will happen. But still, you know, life's good today. Why worry about it, you know? Let's get on with living.
You've described the Japanese espionage in Hong Kong, yes, and its effect. Was there any sign that the Japanese were also attempting subversion in the colony?
That I'm not so sure about. That I don't know. I just don't know.
Do you know if there are any plans for dealing with internal security problems or widespread public disorder in the event of those occurring?
No, I'm not aware of any, no.
Would that have been a police matter rather than a military matter?
I think it probably would have been a police matter, because the army certainly, I had no, I think if it had been an army plan, I would have known about it, because we were in some way attached to every in dealing with every part of the army administration, and I'm not aware that there was anything set aside or staff set aside for this kind of thing. No.
Did you have any impression or opinions or feelings about the Japanese generally, other than them being something of a vague threat?
No, nothing at all, because there were people I'd never met. I never had a chance of meeting them face to face. They existed somewhere else. And I had more than enough interest in the Chinese, the people I was amongst. So my efforts really were devoted to Chinese rather than to thinking beyond that.
Apart from your boat boy spitting over the side at the Japanese spy, did your Chinese friends express any opinions of the Japanese and their plans for a greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere?
No, I didn't really get into much discussion, really. I didn't have many Chinese friends. One lived very much a British life, I'm afraid. One didn't. There wasn't much mixing as such between Chinese and Europeans in those days. It was very separate. We each lived our own went our own ways.
Did the actual outbreak of war come as a surprise, or had you had some political or military warning time before it occurred?
Pretty well none at all. In fact, the Sunday before it happened, I was senior secretary of the Royal Singapore Yacht Club, the Royal Hong Kong Yacht Club, and we were having on the Sunday, this was the 7th of December, an annual race between the Scandinavians, a team race between the Scandinavians and the club and the British. And in the morning we'd had our race, and in the afternoon, in the lunchtime, we came back to the club and there were orders for all service personnel to report to headquarters. So it wasn't until the Sunday, the 7th, the day before, that really one knew that the bloom was going up. And of course, on the morning of the 8th, the first bomb was dropped in Hong Kong, Japanese flew over and dropped some bombs. That was the first thing on the Monday morning. So really, it was up to the Sunday, 7th. And so we had to stop our yacht race and disappear.
What happened to you then when you reported to your headquarters?
I then reported to headquarters, and I was told that to go and, well, first of all, I had a captain who was with me. He was over me. He was Charles. And he and I were then told to go out and to the units to see whether the arrangements they had for supplies of that was working. In other words, we were given a roving commission to go around the island. The island people, we weren't, for some reason, we weren't delegated to the mainland. I don't know why. But my job was to go around the island. The mainland was left, as far as I'm aware.
So you didn't see the gin drinkers line?
No, I didn't go into the mainland at all from the time that the war started. My commitment was entirely to the island.
And the troops in the island were who?
The Middlesex, a Canadian battalion, and the volunteers, by and large.
What sort of condition were the Middlesex in when you saw them?
They were marvellous. The Middlesex had a colonel, Colonel Moncrief, nicknamed Monkey, Monkey Stewart, Moncrief Stewart, nicknamed Monkey. And he was a martinet. And he maintained rigid discipline, but it paid. And because I think they were a strict regiment, they had a pride. And it showed, actually, in the fighting in Hong Kong, the Middlesex never gave way. They were the diehards, and they never gave way. And I remember going out when the battle was, and the Japs were in occupation then of the entire mainland, going out to see the Middlesex to their headquarters at Happy Valley Road. And I was scared stiff. The shells were falling all round headquarters. And there was Monkey Stewart. And I went to see him. And I said, I come to see if there's any problems. He said, yes, Brown. He said, no, Dobie, come. I must go to the Dobie. And I said, I felt like crawling under the nearest thing. There was hell going on around me. And all he thought was fact, well, we've got to be clean. And the Middlesex never gave. They were pushed by the Japanese very hard, but they fell back in orderly. And in fact, their line wasn't broken. In fact, their line was the one defending the area I was eventually in. They were just up the road from me. So the Middlesex were a very good fighting unit. Primarily, in my view, because of the nature of the colonel.
What sort of positions were they occupying? Were they in field works, or were they fortifying buildings, or?
They were in. They were mostly in what I call in emplacements, kind of pillboxes and places of that nature, until they were driven out of them, and then they were in open houses and trenches and so on. In other words, it was make do.
What was it that drove them out?
Intense shelling and pressure, and the Japanese splitting the island. The Japanese, in fact, split the island in two. I may be jumping ahead of this, but they, in fact, when they occupied the mainland, they then started an intense period of shelling on certain things. They first of all shelled the whole emplacements which the Rajputs were in. And the Rajputs one night were completely demoralized because they were just blasted out of into the open. And under the cover of that bombardment, the Japanese landed and then drove right to the center of the island, Wong Nai Chong Gap, and virtually split the island into two. And so the Middlesex were on the western side of this thing, and so they had to hold the Japanese from spreading further westward. That was their role. I mean, they were virtually impromptu with it from that time onwards.
How did the Japanese attack develop? You mentioned a bombing raid.
Yes.
Did the bombing play a large part in their operations, or was it mainly artillery plus infantry?
It was very little. I mean, it was a nuisance more than anything else. I think they caught fire to some oil tanks on the main on the island down on the down the west side, but the bombing, the aerial bombing, was something that one didn't worry. They, in fact, came across the frontier. I think the engineer units that were deployed out there to blow bridges and roads did so and fell back into prepared positions on this line. And the sequence of days I'm not really sure of, but what happened was that the Japanese one night came up and broke through the Royal Scots line. They completely caught the Royal Scots on the hop. And they came right through and broke through their pillboxes and things like that. They just got through the line.
This is a night attack.
A night attack, yes. They came right through. So the result was the whole of the defence line was broken.
This was the Jindrinkers.
That's right, yes. So they were then through it and could therefore roll either way and come right down into Kowloon.
How did you find out about that? Was it from conversations with Royal Scots later on when you were...
Oh, yes.
A POW.
Yes. Oh, no, before that. I mean, because when they fell back, I mean, this is what we knew had happened. I mean, we learned that the Japanese had broken through in the Royal Scots line, and they tried to counterattack, to push it back, but it just failed. They weren't able to push them back. They got through in such numbers.
Was this Japanese attack a surprise? Did they make it by stealth, or was it a noisy attack with lots of support?
Well, this is another thing, see, that which I don't think the British Army realised at that time. The Japanese fought quietly. They wore these soft shoes with split toe, thick rubber soles, but they were quiet. The standard British soldier wore a standard army boot, and you could hear him a mile off walking around. And the Japanese virtually by stealth broke through that line. They came up and they broke through because they weren't expected. But they've been doing this for years in China. They were trained. They knew, and their firearms were first class. Their small their rifles, they were very efficient, and they also had a very effective little mortar, deadly little thing. They were very accurate with it too. Oh, they knew how to fight, and so they really caught, I think, the line on the hop.
You mentioned the shelling of the Rajputs in their pillboxes. What sort of guns did the Japanese use to do that job?
Mostly mortars. Mostly mortars. Almost that was their main thing. In what happened then was it was decided that the mainland couldn't be held. The line had been breached, and no way could the mainland, and therefore other units had to withdraw. And so the Rajputs and the Punjabis and the Canadian Battalion and the Royal Scots were ordered to withdraw. Now, the Punjabis and the Rajputs lost a lot of officers in this operation, and they fell back. The Punjabis didn't, and the Punjabis were a very disciplined force, and as I'll explain later on, I had a Havildar attached to me, and he was on that, in that line, and he wept because he couldn't understand why he'd got to go back. They had a truckload of Japs had come up below them, and they just gunned and got the lot. And as far as they were concerned, the war was good. You know, they knew where they were, they knew what they were doing, and they were on top of the world. Because for them, war was something that was like sport to us. And to be forced to fall back from a position which they reckoned was good hurt them. I mean, their morale was down. But they fell back, and they covered this withdrawal. Of course, the withdrawal was to withdraw back to Limoon Peninsula, to Limoon. The mainland comes down into a point in Kowloon, where the city was, and then you get this big bay where the airfield is, and then you come to a peninsula, a small peninsula, it juts out, which makes Limoon Pass, which is the shortest gap between the mainland and the island. And so the order was to withdraw to Limoon Peninsula. Now, the Punjabis were told to cover the retreat. The other units were to withdraw first. And I was sent out. My boss, who was basically a civilian, but put into uniform as a colonel, was sent out by headquarters with myself and Charles Turner, who was my captain, to act as liaison officers for this withdrawal. So we went out in the evening to the Limoon Pass on the island side, to receive these units coming across. There were some RASC launches, which were the means of bringing them across. And all that night, they came across. And for some incredible reason, the Japanese never detected it. Never found it at all. It was quite remarkable.
So they weren't under pressure at all, or in
contact? They weren't under pressure. There was pressure. Yes, there was. But the Punjabis did it. The Punjabis were on a reverse slope of this thing. And so that when the Japanese appeared, they were just sitting ducks. I mean, they didn't sit on top of the ridge. They sat just below the ridge. And the Japanese really had a mauling from the Punjabis.
The Japanese were skylined as they came
Japanese
over.
Japanese skylined, yes. They were in trouble, and they couldn't see really what was there. They brought mortars into play, but the Punjabis held. And before dawn, just as dawn broke, we got the last man across onto the other side.
What happened to the Punjabis? Did they withdraw?
They withdrew too. They withdrew too. Yes, it was a very regular withdrawal, and the Japs didn't press at this point. It was quite remarkable that we were allowed to do this.
Perhaps the Japanese were expecting the island to give up quietly after the mainland was lost.
They did, yes. I'm not sure when they sent a number of things to the governor to surrender. There were two or three surrender messages sent to the governor. No, nothing was done. It wasn't accepted. But we'd withdraw. And so, therefore, we were now all on the island. And they were deployed accordingly. The Punjabis were kept back as a kind of reserve battalion. And the Rajputs, I say, manned the north shore in these pillboxes. And the Canadians were sent over onto the eastern side of the island, round the Stanley Peninsula and across the eastern side. And there were a few days when it was mostly shelling. But by this time, the headquarters discovered that battle headquarters was, in fact, almost the nearest point to the Japanese, who had now arrived on the Kowloon Peninsula opposite. And there was every possibility of an attack coming across and, in fact, taking battle headquarters. So the Brigadier AQ decided we'd have to have a battle headquarters defense force. And so Charles Turner, the captain, RSC, and myself were made OC and second in command of Battle Headquarters Defence Force. And we were told our job was to find out the weak points of headquarters and to see that they were safeguarded. And we were given a collection of Royal Scots, Mule Corps, Veterinary Corps, odds and ends of every unit pretty well on the island to say, well, these are chaps to spare, and some volunteers. They were Eurasian volunteers. Do what you will with them and make a defence force.
How many of them did you have altogether?
About 50. And one of the things we discovered was that you could come in through an underground drain, quite a big drain, from the dockyard, through the dockyard, and virtually right inside Battle Headquarters itself. I mean, the whole of the drainage system. So we had the manhole opened, where it was nearest the headquarters, and I put a poor Eurasian section of Hong Kong volunteers to watch the manhole to see that there was no infiltration coming. There was anybody who had to come at there and put a whole lot of explosives right on the headquarters, and that would have been the end of that. We had a post on Devo Road just below headquarters. There was a section down there with a machine gun and lights covering the road. And we had another section above us in Kennedy Road to cover anything coming from the top, because it was absolutely open for a direct assault, and so we were the closest. In fact, it never materialized, but it was a possibility. That's how I found myself in charge of a so-called defense force. In fact, we lost 11 of our Japs on the Kennedy Road, because every afternoon the Japs used to have what we call a hate. And they used to plaster the whole area with these howitzer, the shells used to come down, mortar shell. And they used to arrive. They used to go off before you even knew they'd come. I mean, they'd come and then you heard the bang. And one of them hit one of our trenches. And one man came out alive. The rest were blown to bits. Tom Sawyer, who was a veterinary corps, He came out alive. Quite remarkable.
How did you decide upon where to actually dig your slip trenches and how to position them?
We really looked around at the method of the probable approaches that could be made. Clearly, they were the roads, and both top and bottom, and the sides. We had to. We accepted that there would be a defence on to the west of us, because the east of us rather. They were the Middlesex, and we were in touch with the Middlesex, and they were there. And on the other side, well, we reckoned that there was. I don't think there was much danger felt coming from the other side, because the Japanese were then on the island and coming through. So it was really behind us, really. So we kept really three sides. One, we kept the Middlesex. We looked at the bottom and we looked at the top. We found that there was a battle headquarters mentality. In the battle headquarters, there was a feeling that one was safe.
Because they were in concrete.
Because you were in concrete. You didn't hear the sound of war. You didn't know anything about it at all. And the going out into hell, well, of noise... and periodic, you know, bombardment. You were scared stiff. And Charles and I realised that this was no good at all. We just got to be outside. Because when you were outside for a few hours or for a day, you realise, you know, well, that was like to be close and that wasn't close, and therefore you accepted it. You calm down and you think. And so we made our own headquarters in the old headquarters, a peacetime headquarters above ground. We had a room at the back, and that was we made our place, because we realised that if we went down and up and down, our morale would suffer, because there really was a battle headquarters defence men mentality, and some men did not want to leave and did not leave. They virtually lived down there.
When you were running this defence force, battle issue defence force, were you also having to carry on your previous duties
of sorting out logistic
problems?
At that time, I mean, units were on their own. By then, the Japanese, I was living in a boarding house on Kennedy Road above the headquarters in peacetime called Courtlands. And when war broke out, officers of the headquarters were accommodated in this. This was supposed to be the headquarters of mess almost. We were accommodated there. And I remember one night, I was there, and I heard this terrific bombardment going, and I thought, that's jolly good, we're giving the Japs hell. Because at this time, the 16-inch guns at Stanley, which were only designed as fire at sea, were in fact swiveled right round and were firing right over the island onto the Japanese. I mean, it's quite remarkable. The whole thing was swung round 180 degrees. They were firing right over the island on the other side. And I felt that the Japs, I mean, it really was almost continuous. What I didn't realise until later that night was it was in fact with the Japanese bombardment of the whole of this North Shore, and then landing and splitting the island into two. So we were living in this boarding house, Kennedy Road, and a lot of officers did not, in fact, they eventually didn't come back to the headquarters. They stayed below. Lived down below.
Were they armed, and were they organised to defend the headquarters if the Japanese broke into it?
No. Not in any way. They carried on as if it was a normal thing.
Was that headquarters gas-proofed?
No, we had gas masks, because we used to have gas drills in peacetime, you know, before the war broke out. They used to let off tear gas. We used to have to sit in our gas masks in the office for a until it dissipated. No, it wasn't gas-proofed, no. Just bomb-proof.
Did the shelling and the occasional bombing have any visible effect upon the morale of the civil population?
No. No, I'm not aware of any panic, anything at all. I went, well, days when I was going around the island, I mean, one went on a car, there was no visible signs of it at all. No, they just carried on.
What about the withdrawal from the mainland to the island? Did that have any visible effect upon attitudes and outlook?
No, not that I'm aware of either. I think it was just a shrug, except philosophically. This was what it was. I saw going back to the battle for a moment, I had a number of friends who were in the Wavy Navy, because you know, we were sailing, and the MTB flotilla. And after the Japs had landed on Lime, and of course they began to cross in daylight, you could see the boats coming across, it was decided to send the MTB flotilla around to attack. It was pathetic. It was dreadful, really. I mean, it was suicide. These six little boats came round, and I saw two just hit with mortar and just burst into flames, go out of control. Only two, in fact, escaped. I mean, they were sent round to try and break up the landing craft, but it was just suicide. I mean, they were just disappeared.
Were the Japanese using purpose-built landing craft for this operation?
Do you know, I didn't think I really saw them close to.
Did the Japanese have a naval escort to try and cover this hop across the water?
No.
So the MTBs came under fire from ground?
From ground, yes. There was nothing at all. Nothing at all on the water at all. No, nothing.
Did they have any impact at all on the Japanese?
No, they never got near them. They were demolished before they could do anything. And I say to see one's friends just blown up, you know, with no chance of doing a thing at all. They before they got within 100 yards, you know, for several hundred yards of them, they were gone. It was just one of these unfortunate things.
Did the Royal Air Force do anything that you saw while you were there?
They could do nothing. And I don't know what planes they had, but they disappeared in the first few days. There was nothing at all in the air on our side. We had plenty of aircraft guns going, but I'm not aware that they did any real damage either.
What sort of height did the Japanese bomb from when they did bomb?
Difficult to say. Their planes weren't very big. I wouldn't have said more than about 1,000 feet. And really, one looking back, the whole thing was really quite absurd. We had in the battle headquarters a war room, and there was a map, a relief map of the Hong Kong Island and the territories. And there were people with poles pushing things around, saying, well, there's an aircraft coming over and going here and everywhere. But it seemed so fatuous. I mean, they were over you. I mean, there was no, but I mean, it was there it was. There was a proper war room. And the other thing that struck me, almost as an onlooker, was how few senior officers ever went outside that battle box.
Who was the commander at the time?
Maltby. General Maltby, yes.
Did he stay in the battle box?
Yes,
or did
yes.
He never went out to look at units?
No. Neither did Brigadier Peffers. In fact, my boss, Kilpatrick, was sent out two layers of units as a full colonel. And he was rated a civilian. And I'm sorry to say this, but, you know, it was a feature that hit me, because it felt all so wrong that communication was entirely by telephone.
Did the communications work well?